Matt Welch, one of my favorite libertarian intellectual sparring partners and editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, and Maya Wiley, a civil rights attorney and founder and president of the Center for Social Inclusion. All right, Matt, I want to start with you because it feels to me like this is a negative, positive freedom, a libertarian versus big state question. Where do you fall on this?
Well, I know you're not going to steal my daughter because you didn't do it when you had the chance. My problem with what your statement was that from my perspective, the premise of it was wrong, mm-hmm. right? We don't lack for spending money on public education in this country. Yeah. We spend three times as much per capita, per student, as we did in 1970, with the exact same results as we had, more or less, in 1970. So we already have a social contract where we have said everywhere that every kid has a right to public education. That exists, and yet public education is not performing. So that is what we need, I think, to confront, not some notion that it's our overly private sense of our children that we have to somehow break through. No, we've broken through that, actually. What we haven't done is translate that into better education.
So, you know, it's interesting. We're going to get into education more concretely as we move into the second hour, but I do want to, in part, put a finger on what you just said, that, okay, we've already broken through that, because in fact, that is the part that I thought would be non-controversial. I thought that there was, in fact, on both the left and the right, this sense that, look, kids are part of our collective responsibility, no child left behind. It really has been surprising to me to discover that the sort of angle of the debate this week wasn't about public education funding, which to me is debatable, but instead was about whether or not we, in fact, do have a kind of private ownership stake in our kids.
Well, I think there are two things happening here. One is that the attack on what you said was taken grossly out of context by those who were making the attack, and they weren't actually talking about what you were talking about,
sure.
which was an actual debate about, are we actually funding enough for public education or are we not, right? Which is a legitimate conversation we can have. So I think we should acknowledge that that was not either fair or intellectually, I think, very legitimate.
But thank you.
I do think you're raising this underlying point, which is, what is society's social contract? And I think actually we have seen it shifting, and we've also seen arguments about the fact that it should shift, mm-hmm. which is what you're pointing to. So, for example, in Mississippi, where there have been tremendous inroads in changing the education formula for a state that has one of the lowest performing public school systems, in part that reform was to try to ensure that funds were going to the kids who needed them the most. Mm-hmm. Now Mississippi has slashed the budget for that reformulation about how it spends. So it does have impacts on whether we're all taking care of each other's children.
You know, it's interesting that you bring up Mississippi, in part because, you know, as I've been trying to think through this response, it's one of the places where I've felt some sense of agreement with people on the other side of the reproductive choice argument, right? So people who have a position on pro-life typically also understand that the child is separate from the parent, right? It's just that for me, child begins with birth, and for them, child begins with conception, right? But they're based still on a fundamental idea that, in fact, there's a collective interest in an infant that does not belong to you biologically. And in fact, in the first quarter of 2013, we've seen states propose 694 new provisions to address unborn children. So I was sort of shocked that the right would say to me, oh no, you know, your kid is your kid to dispose of as you want, because in fact that seems not to be the position.
Well, let's acknowledge that language here matters.
Okay. I mean,
there's a different thing, you know, there's one point to say that society has recognized that there is a community responsibility for handling children or having public policy that affects children that are not their own. There's a difference between saying that and saying we have to get over this private notion that our kids belong to ourselves. Kids and parenthood is kind of a sensitive topic.
It is, right, no doubt.
You might have learned this week. And so when you say we have to get over this notion, people say, hold on, you know, I have that notion. I mean, this is a country that accepts as asylum refugees those who are not allowed to homeschool their kids in other countries, mm-hmm. right? They have a pretty private notion of it, and they've paid for it dearly, and we have acknowledged this as a country, as you should be able to do that if that's what you want to do. So, I mean, it's a sensitive discussion.
Interesting. Well, we're going to go to break. because I want to get really into the policy questions of housing and of education and all of this on exactly this topic. We're going to stay for the next 2 hours on the question of collective responsibilities. But before I go, I do also want to just give us an opportunity to listen to somebody else who said something very similar to this. It's my not so much ideological twin, Colin Powell. Let's listen to him as we go.
Where the family is broken or where the family is not up to the task, the rest of us must step in to help as mentors, tutors, foster parents, friends to kids who desperately need responsible adults to show them the way. Tens of thousands of our neighbors have already stepped forward. Tens of thousands who realize that our children are a gift from God, not only to their parents, but to all of us. They belong to us all. We are all responsible for them.
For the last 40 years, a bipartisan Congress has kept up a commitment to fund the housing choice vouchers that have kept low-income families from becoming homeless. The Section 8 voucher program offers a subsidy for families with children who are living below the poverty line, the elderly, and people with disabilities who would be unable to afford housing without financial help, to find the housing of their choice on the private market. It's a policy decision that puts into action our collective understanding that every American has the right to a safe, affordable place to call home. And for most of the last four decades, that policy has had solid support from both sides of the aisle in Congress, which has renewed vouchers nearly every year for families currently enrolled in the program. Until now. After Congress dropped the meat cleaver of sequestration on March 1, hacking away at domestic spending, families like those who depend on Section 8 will soon be the ones feeling the cuts. And the sequester will force the local agencies responsible for administering the vouchers to eliminate housing assistance for up to 140,000 families. This human cost of sequestration is detailed in a new report from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and it's the subject of a column by The Nation's This Week in Poverty writer and Nerdland friend, Greg Kaufman. He joins us here today at the table, along with Lisa Cook, Assistant Professor of Economics and International Relations at Michigan State University. So, Greg, I want to start with you because you wrote passionately about this. Looks like the sequester is getting real, and it's getting real for poor people. What's at stake here?
Well, we're just moving in the wrong direction from a collective perspective. I mean, if you think about the people who are receiving housing vouchers, the average income for the household is $12,500 a year. As you mentioned, half of the recipients are people with disabilities or seniors. The other half are families with children. Only twice in the last 40 years did we not renew the vouchers, did we cut them down. And you know what? That was under George W. Bush. And those vouchers still haven't come back. Yep. So what we need to realize is that if we go in this direction, $140,000 vouchers lost, we can't count on them coming back anytime soon, even though demand for them is rising. And only one in four families receive them who are eligible.
I was going to say, part of it is, this isn't about expanding eligibility, right? It's that even in this moment, only one in four receive them. We were looking at the figure of how sequestration is going to create this funding shortfall, and it is pretty stunning where you can see the little cuts, but then there's this huge cut that happens when sequestration hits, and all of a sudden you see this big dramatic drop. So Lisa, I wanted to, there's that drop, right? That's the drop that happens with the housing voucher shortfall. So Lisa, I want to ask in part, we could make a sort of ethical or moral argument about the need to help people without means to have housing, but what's the economic cost to suddenly having 140,000 new homeless families?
It's huge and it's sinister. So homelessness is the first thing that we should be concerned about. We should be concerned about the recovery. So this housing demand that's pent up, certainly if one could accommodate many of those, we would see housing construction pick up. So what we have is a nascent housing recovery. We have housing starts that have been increasing. We have housing prices that have been increasing. We want to keep this going. This is still a fragile recovery. And one more knock, this could be death by a million cuts.
So, Matt, I know that Section 8 is exactly the kind of sort of market thing, sort of intervention by the government. The libertarians typically say, whoa, that is going to create a lot of negative externalities that you don't even mean to be creating.
Well, let's pull the focus backwards a little bit here and talk about sequester and government spending as a whole and how it relates to this. Bill Clinton's last budget was $1.8 trillion. Barack Obama's first was $3.6 trillion, right? So we've spent a lot more money as a government, much of that under George W. Bush. We've increased the cost of government over that time. So every government program, military, everything has been goosed for the last 10 years. And so when you cut this much and then you have these terrible outcomes, you have to ask the question, what did we do with that money before? And then if we think on any given day, government spending is a zero-sum game. So you're competing for different things. When you're giving money to Monsanto in the form of farm subsidies, that money is not going to Section 8. So if you treasure a safety net, which you do, you need to look around, and everyone needs to look around, what are we spending money on that we shouldn't? Why is the cost of government going through the roof when we don't feel like we're getting the same benefits out of the other end?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're definitely not going to get me to support Monsanto. Like, yeah, let's get rid of that. I mean, that's right. That's clearly exactly the kind of giveaway that's problematic. But, you know, the one thing I would wonder about, though, Matt, is the way that you formulated that. You said that there's a zero-sum game, which also assumes a fixed pie. And the other possibility is that you can ask wealthier people to pay a fairer share.
That's right. So part of the, I mean, of course, part of that increase in spending, Matt, is talking about also went to actually try to re-energize the economy to the tune of over $700 billion, which is actually the exact same thing that George Bush did. So, you know, there's no question that there are times when we must spend, we should spend, and it actually helps us solve some of our problems. I also agree that we have to look at what we're spending on, but the reality is we've also been cutting the revenue. And if we don't start thinking about how we invest in corporations like Monsanto, who are getting public dollars to make private profit, are also often paying very little to nothing in taxes. So they're not part of investing in our children's future collectively the way the rest of us are.
Melissa, and also, I mean, while I agree that we need to look at how money is spent, obviously, you know, there's still the issue of these 140,000 families. Mm-hmm. And this is already starting to take effect. I mean, and I'm not trying to pick on New Orleans, but recently, you know, they had given vouchers to 700 families on the waiting list, and the families hadn't found places yet, and they said, hold on, we need those back. And that's not just New Orleans, that's happening lots of places. Normally, say I have a voucher, and then I get a good job, so I don't need it anymore. Matt's next in line, he would get it. They're not giving them out. They're saying we're going to hold on to it. San Diego just said no more vouchers until 2014. 30,000 people are on the waiting list. And so ultimately, and they're writing people who have vouchers now and saying, hey, you're good now, but by the end of the year, you might not have it. And all of these things, the Center on Budget Policy report by Doug Rice, who just did a phenomenal job, they suggest that all of these things are going to drive families to neighborhoods with higher crime, lower performing schools, and less access to jobs.
Yeah. And we know that the impact then on children is a lifetime impact, right? So children who are in deep poverty in their young years end up having a lifetime, a 70% likelihood that they're also going to live in poverty. There's another side to this housing story that we're going to continue to talk about, and that's the piece that is that's at the top. It's about home ownership and foreclosure. But before we go to break, it feels like a good time just to mention this. My book, Sister Citizen, is now out in paperback. Just saying. Up next, we're going to continue to talk about this housing issue and the issue of even if you're paying your mortgage, how you still might lose your house.
Those families that have been victims of illegal foreclosures, will you be giving them the information that's in your possession about how the banks illegally foreclosed against them? Mr. Ashton?
I think that's a decision that we're still considering. We haven't made a final decision yet.
So you have made a decision to protect the banks, but not a decision to tell the families who were illegally foreclosed against?
Maya, I saw you wanting to jump in on exactly this issue before the break.
Well, there's so much to say on this issue. I don't know where to start. But, I mean, I think the important thing about this conversation about balanced, we do need a balanced housing policy. We do need rental and homeownership. And the thing we can't lose right now, in many cities, it's actually cheaper to own a home and pay a mortgage than to pay rent. And at the same time, you can actually grow assets. You can grow wealth that helps you invest in your children, whether you own them or the community.
And the important thing about that, particularly for communities of color, this voucher issue, you know, lots of people of color with this voucher have a really hard time finding a landlord who will rent to them.
Yep.
And so we have to be honest about that. The mobility issue is big and important, but we can't assume that just because a person has the voucher, mm-hmm. they will be able to make use of the voucher. Some of these cuts are the supports for actually getting the assistance to find the place who will take the voucher. And those support systems are getting cut as well.
It's such an important point that you made about, on the one hand, there's this kind of imperative towards homeownership, and we can say, oh, we have to do away with that. But the fact is, for communities, particularly African-American Latino communities that have seen the evaporation of wealth right. since 2008, right? The idea that, and all that wealth was in their homes. How are they going to rebuild it? How will they regrow it?
And that is an essential question. How are you going to ground families? So what we know, what economists know about homeownership and being in a home, so not just purchasing a home, is that students, children in those homes, have the opportunity to study quietly, study in dedicated spaces, for example, just on a simple level. So again, what we're thinking about is either we pay now mm-hmm. or we pay later. This is going to have devastating effects. And if we're asking how we're going to rebuild wealth, we have to consider home ownership. We have to consider a lot of other things. Yep. I'll go back to financial education. Maybe it's that we just need to learn to diversify our assets a lot more. And some of them are not performing the way they did 10 years ago, to say the bond market. So we need to be educated about all the assets we could own.
And you know, that child investment piece, when you were talking about things that go wrong when you end up homeless or you end up in these tough circumstances, Greg, you talk about lead poisoning in your piece.
Yeah, I mean, definitely one of the, a lot of programs are being cut yep. in HUD, and one of the programs is to minimize exposure to lead for children in older units. So that's one of the things that's just being cut. So that's going to be a problem. But on this issue of the foreclosure report mm-hmm. And the big banks, I mean, I think nobody's, I mean, they're horrible numbers, but I can't think anybody's really shocked that this is the banking mm-hmm. bank's behavior. And you know, six banks still control 73% mm-hmm. of the banking of the assets in the banking sector. So I really think we have to take on the big banks directly still. And to that point, I would just say that and collective responsibility. In Idaho on Tuesday, U.S. Bank is having its annual shareholders meeting, and they're in Idaho because last year they were at their corporate headquarters in Minneapolis, and activists basically took over the meeting. So they're going to Idaho, but activists are coming from Minnesota. SEIU 503, largest union in Oregon is going, mm-hmm. and citizens from Idaho. So these are people coming together from far and wide to help their neighbors with these issues.
Yeah, Matt.
Here's something to think about with all this, however, is that housing is a classic government policy where well-intentioned policies, including trying to create more affordable housing, create the exact opposite of what you want. Because we have this idea that home ownership is so important, we over-incentivize home ownership and we drive up the cost. Mm-hmm. Look around the country where housing is cheapest compared to what it should be, or what we think of as normally. Texas has very cheap housing. Texas doesn't go around saying, we're going to pass this law for affordable housing. They don't really care about that so much. But what they don't have is a lot of restrictions on what you can do with your property. They don't have all these sort of government things that add to the cost of it.
Right. I mean, undoubtedly there. I mean, we got to go because there's commercials and paying for this show and all that. But I mean, I get you. There really are market distortions that occur for as a variety of reasons. But on the other hand, when you have low income folks who are simply priced out of markets and they are the economic supports, right? For example, the city of New York. Without low-income housing programs from the government, all of the people who work to make this city actually run would be unable to live
and
here.
And those government programs help create the middle class, and we should not forget that. Yeah. They can be fixed, and there are some fixes we need, but they're important.
I want to say thanks to Greg Kaufman and to Lisa Cook. Matt and Maya are going to stick around. They'll be back later in the program. But up next, community outreach gone wrong. It's my letter, and it's to Senator Rand Paul. Welcome back. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. We've been talking a bit about the controversy that erupted this week over a promo ad I shot for our network, in which I advocate for community involvement in the lives of our children. But somewhere along the line, my main intent in the statement, in fact, the very first line, kind of got lost in the kerfuffle.
We have never invested as much in public education as we should have.
So that's it. That was the thing I was going for and trying to explain. And my main point was and remains that we need to invest more of our national resources in public education. And for that, I've received boatloads of not so nice responses this week. But all things considered, at least I'm still here and able to give my response. Getting even more hate mail than me this week, even though she's no longer with us, was the recently departed former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. The neoliberal Cold War warrior was not remembered fondly by all, and in part because of her radical campaign to privatize much of Great Britain's industries. And of course, across the pond at the same time, President Ronald Reagan was taking similar steps. Both figures and the work of the neoliberal project of the 1980s have in large part set the stage that my promo ad was debuted upon. Both of these leaders saw their countries as nations at risk, in large part because of the state of disrepair plaguing our public education systems. And so their answer was reformation via competition. The road to education reform would be driven by market forces, which manifested in the form of policies such as school choice, high-stakes testing, and school closings. But perhaps most significantly, the result was a lasting impulse to seek solutions to our public sector problems with the private market. And it is with that backdrop that my ask for more public investment in public education was met. Because to me, when I see a collective problem, I tend to think there's a collective solution. So with me this morning is Matt Welch, editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, Maya Wiley, a civil rights attorney and founder and president of the Center for Social Inclusion, Sheena Wright, president and CEO of the nonprofit organization United Way of New York City, and Lisa Cook, assistant professor of economics and international relations at Michigan State University. So I'm going to come back to you, Matt, because early on in the show, you said, that's just not right, Melissa. We have not failed to invest in public education. Make your claim.
We spend, on average, per capita, per student, adjusted for inflation since 1970, about three times as much.
As we did previously.
So that's a graph that goes like this. The achievement graph goes like this. So it says to me that the question is not, are we investing enough? It's how is that money being invested and why isn't it working?
Now, Matt, when I look at dollars spent per student, it's actually down in most states since 2008, right? So you're talking about a kind of longer trend line, right, which you say is going up like this. But then when I look at sort of per state spending, it is those red lines are the amount down that it is in Alabama, California, Idaho, all the way down. So the only ones on the plus side are Tennessee to North Dakota, and that's since 2008, so that's the most recent.
Does that measure, stimulus money and federal money that's been put into education?
So this is, as far as I understand, these are, in fact, all dollars spent per student in these localities, and that they have dropped. Now, that drop is, of course, recent over the longer trend line that you're suggesting, but let me suggest, Lauren, let me ask you this. Is it possible that we are missing some of the dollars that we are spending because we're not really spending them on education? We're spending them on things like free and reduced lunches. We're spending them on things that in other countries that provide more of a social safety net, kids already come to school with them. So they're not getting invested in educational resources. They're getting invested in poverty alleviation resources.
Right. And they're also getting invested in administration, famously. And this is happening in the higher education system, which you know as well, that it's not necessarily going straight to teachers. Teachers have a good claim that they haven't seen their budgets go up. Right. You know, by three times, but there's been a lot more bureaucracy. There's been a lot more school building in a very expensive way, so it hasn't been spent wisely in the classroom.
You're asking a really important question, Melissa. One of the things to note is that when we're looking at education spending, charter schools. So one of the big innovations that's supposed to help us correct, some of these academic achievement issues is charter schools. There are some really, really good charter schools. There's some really, really bad charter schools. Mm-hmm. But research coming out of Texas has just shown that actually charter schools in Texas, their administrative costs are twice the administrative costs of traditional public schools. So I think actually one of the things, we saw this in Mississippi as well, where actually low-income schools that were predominantly black actually had higher administrative costs. I think if you got under that, I think you would see some of the things that you're talking about, which are that they are trying to supplement a lot of needs that come from being in high-poverty communities, and you can't really solve schools and educational achievement if you're not actually looking at what kind of investments
investments we're making in families, in communities.
Yep. I would agree that certainly we have to think about how we're spending the money, but I would also think about the level. I guess I'm the only person here who teaches at a public university, mm-hmm. and it seems to me that I am not getting what actually the university needs and what the students need. Mm-hmm. So because of the $1.1 trillion college debt problem and because of the recession, we have less tools to deal with the tremendous demand that has grown in public schools and public universities. So yes, relative to our pay, the administrator's pay is going up. I'm not going to say much more because I don't want to get in trouble.
But, well, deans are doing better than professors.
Exactly.
We can leave it at that. Yes.
We're just going to leave it at that. But certainly, the demand is coming to our side. We cannot meet this overwhelming demand, and we need to be the ones doing it. Mm-hmm. We've got to be able to provide better value for money, and we have to think about educating all of our children as much as we can. Either we're doing it collectively or individually, but the dollars have to come from the federal government, I think.
And I think another really important issue is the profound disparity in yep. the allocation of resources. Yep. New York State was right the subject of a major lawsuit from the Campaign for Fiscal Equity, which really laid out very concretely that lower income communities were not getting even their fair share of what was supposed to be allocated per pupil. And it was a deliberate act that needed a remedy. So even in the decline or the increase or whatever it might be, in some of the most challenging communities, they're not even getting their fair share.
Yeah, and this is a historic wrong. So this is also, I guess, part of my concern about the sort of long timeline. So I had a student who wrote a really brilliant thesis in part about the inequities in the public school system and was looking at some of the numbers in the city of New Orleans, in the state of Louisiana, in the 1930s and 40s, where $63 was being spent per white child and $17 per black child, and that these schools had sort of 27 students per teacher in white schools, but 42 per teacher in black schools. So that's 1940, when we expect, of course, in a place like Louisiana to have a huge disparity. But it does dig a hole quite deep that even when you start putting resources in, still doesn't necessarily get us to an even space when we start talking about things like the achievement gap.
You know, my kids are in public school system in New York. Mm-hmm. And the elementary school that my 9-year-old is in is predominantly free and reduced lunch. They got to be 157 different languages in that school, yeah. right? It's highly diverse, but it's diverse non-white. Mm-hmm. And it's highly low income, all right? And the thing that I see in that school, but that school is in a district that's a high wealth district. Hmm. So even though it's a low income, the population of the school, but for my kids and a few others, are low income, it's benefiting from a district that is able to provide additional resources to the school. And so I see it every day in my kids' classroom, and I recognize the difference in the school that's, by the way, four blocks away from my house as well, with the same student population in a different district, mm-hmm. right? And districts are not supposed to have any meaning anymore right. in New York City school system, but it still does. Right. There's no wealth in that district.
So
we can't separate these things. The costs of educating these kids are not the same because of some of these issues.
But even your indication that you can have a relatively poor public school population within a relatively high wealth district, I wonder, Matt, in part about the question of school choice, right, and parental individual choice for your kids. Because part of how that happens is that wealthy families started opting out of the school system. Right, even beyond the white flight that we saw from cities was the white flight that we saw from schools, and then just the wealth flight right from these schools. So on the one hand, I want people to have choice, right? I mean, who doesn't want parents to be able to do the best for their kids? But I worry about what's left behind.
Yes. The way I look at it is this. I'm worried. I just moved from Washington, D.C. to Brooklyn, New York, and I moved because because PS 58 is a damn good school, and they have a French immersion class for kindergartners. It's perfect for my daughter. I can afford to do that.
Right.
That ain't a cheap neighborhood anymore.
Yeah.
Precisely because of that school, I can't just morally justify a system in which I have that choice and the mobility to move, but people who don't have the means to do that are sentenced to their neighborhood school. I just can't justify that system. And I mean, the achievement is yet to be seen. I think it's about a wash in schools of choice, but parental satisfaction is much higher. And that says to me that it means something.
Interesting. So we're going to stay on exactly this conversation. And in fact, I encourage everyone at home to engage in this conversation with us on our website, mhpshow.com. And also, anyone in the market for a lovely, slightly used pink sweater? I have put on eBay the sweater that I wore when recording the Lean Forward spot. All of the proceeds will go to the Children's Defense Fund. Go bid on the sweater and stay right there after the break, where President George W. Bush and I agree.
The federal government can spend money, and we can help set standards, and we can insist upon accountability. But the truth of the matter is, our schools will flourish when citizens join in the noble cause of making sure no child is left behind.
That was President George W. Bush signing his landmark education bill, No Child Left Behind, and sounded a little bit like me in the Lean Forward commercial. No, not really. Well, maybe a little bit, right? In the sense that I can't help but to agree with him there, that we all have a stake in making sure that no child in this country is left out or left behind, especially when it comes to education. It really is in our national interest to have a well-educated populace. So I wanted to ask you in part about sort of how then organizations like United Way and others in the nonprofit sector end up filling the gap when parents can't.
United Way supports over 1,000 nonprofits here in New York City, and those nonprofits are on the front lines in communities where schools are failing, and they stand in the gap. They're providing the after-school services, the support for families, the financial empowerment, affordable housing, stability, all of those things that families need and children need in order to be successful in school. And so without that safety net that's created by this incredibly important industry and sector, our children will not be successful in school, because we know all of those things impact educational outcomes.
So make an argument for me about where that funding should come from, right? So, I could be a supporter of things like United Way or nonprofits and say, as many conservatives do, that is exactly what civil society should do. Government should not be in the business of that. Individuals should be making a choice about donating some portion of their income, or the sale of their pink sweaters to places like United Way.
The public sector absolutely has to invest in this type of educational infrastructure and all the things that we need, as does the private sector, as does individuals. We do need the collective resources of the entire community in order to support these really, really important social supports for families. It's absolutely imperative. When you talk about, the kind of historical underpinnings of the disparities in investment, the black children got $17 and the white children got $63, I think one of the things that we have to really understand and appreciate is that our educational system is based on inequity and disparity. It was built to ensure that we had a working class. They didn't need a certain level of education. Mm-hmm. We wanted people to be able to be on those assembly lines, etc. Now we have a knowledge-based economy. We need everyone to have the maximum opportunity to reach their full potential in order for all of us to be successful. It impacts our GDP, it impacts the business sector, and so everybody's got to weigh in. Everybody's got to lean in to get the job done.
So the problem, though, with a collective good, though, a public good, is that there's always an individual incentive to shirk, right? There's always an individual incentive not to be the one person paying in so that you can still get the collective good. What are the incentives for individuals and individual households, especially if they're not in the public schools, to make sure that they're supporting the public schools?
So I would go back to what I was talking about earlier. You're going to pay one way or the other. The question is how smartly you're investing your money. So let's say that you don't invest in public education, or you don't invest in nonprofits that help to support public education. So what is the outcome? So what are these folks doing rather than getting educated? They're going to prison. They're not reaching their potential. And we're losing out not just on GDP now, but we're losing out on GDP in the future, well-being in the future, and GDP GDP isn't everything. I certainly understand that. But health and other desirable outcomes for the society are going to lose out. All of these will lose out if we don't say that we're going to contribute at some point. For me, it is an investment question. Are you going to do it now? Are you going to do it later?
Mm-hmm. You see, this is where we have to talk about race. And this is what I thought was part of the underpinning of your Lean Forward ad. If we recognize that we're an us, then it doesn't matter that that half of all 18-year-olds and under are Black, Latino, Asian, Native American, right? And so when one of the things that we're seeing is, well, people will make decisions about investing, if we went to a pure private strategy, what they'd say is, I will invest in my neighborhood's school. So that's me taking care of my neighbor's kids. But guess what? Most of our neighbors look like us, which means we're not actually recognizing. And all our communities are not in the same position. A friend of mine once said to me, I know exactly what a high-quality education costs. And I said, you do? You know, and the policy wonk community was like, give me the site. Like, I'm going to use that. And he said, well, it's $15,000 a year. And I said, well, how do you know? And he said, because that's what the private school down the road is charging.
Right.
And I went, oh, good point. And our kids are getting $8,000. So, I do think that we can't just say money doesn't matter when we know that for folks that are getting high levels of quality education, they're paying a lot of money for it. And the question is, how do we make sure that even as we become more and more diverse and we are living still very separately, that we are actually making it beyond community? And that's the problem with a purely kind of private charity model is we'll take care of who we know, and who we know are people who tend to look like us, which means our resources are not being shared in the most strategic and effective way for the country.
But let's acknowledge that we don't live in the private charity model. We live in the public school K through 12 model. We have a much more private model on higher education, and higher education also works better. It's pretty widely acknowledged, and you get a lot of K through 12 people who can't cope with higher education because they haven't been trained. So, I mean, I feel like a little bit we're talking about kind of a straw man of, you know, we're not sufficiently, you know, deciding to fund education. Well, I think we kind of are. I mean, in California, where I'm from, 40% of all government money has to go to education, K through 12. That's just by law. So that decision has kind of already been made. Another thing about the us and the collective thing, and it affects education on some level, is that kids are getting ensnared in the criminal justice system in this country, and there has not been any political will to say that's wrong. We are creating 2 million prisoners here. That is an international disgrace, and they're being locked up for things they shouldn't be locked up
for. I'm so glad that you've made that turn, because that's exactly what we're going to talk about just a little bit later in the show, because in fact, the First Lady showed this just extraordinary empathy in her conversation about guns, but of course the guns piece and the drug war piece and the incarceration piece are all interlocking for so many children who then don't have the educational opportunities. So more on that. But up next, I got a little story about a little community activist who could, how an 8-year-old helped turn back a bad bill. Way back to Washington from his Monday gun speech in Connecticut, President Obama brought along with him on Air Force One families of the Newtown shooting victims. They weren't just grieving family members anymore. They were now advocates about to channel their collective loss towards a tangible result, convincing U.S. senators not only to pass background check legislation, but first to even let it come up for debate. And those they couldn't convince, they tweeted. The 14 Republican senators who threatened to filibuster the Thursday cloture vote got a social media message from Erica Lafferty, the daughter of the late principal of Sandy Hook Elementary, Don Hochsprung. She sent this to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell's press office. Hey, here's a pic of my mom and sister on her wedding day. I don't get that at my wedding in July. This to Senator Pat Roberts. My mom was gunned down at Sandy Hook. Allison, the baby there, will never know her grandma. We don't deserve to be heard. And this to her followers, going through the list of senators threatening to filibuster, calling them one by one. I will be heard. And the message got through. The Senate dodged the GOP-led filibuster effort, agreeing 68-31 to allow the bill to proceed. But what will happen when it goes to the Republican-led House? All right.
Newtown is the other side of this. If Hydea Pendleton and handgun violence in Chicago is one side, the other side is this mass killing. And it did feel to me like one of the things Newtown did was move us towards a gun control debate, because those kids did feel like our kids, because they were young, because they were in school, because they had families that had done everything right. As horrific as this tragedy is this where we finally get legislation?
This is going to be a hard battle. And I think the problem here is that the National Rifle Association is spending a lot of gun manufacturer money to make sure that gun manufacturers still make money. Because the reality is the NRA is no longer representing the interests of its members, because most of its members support this legislation.
Particularly the background checks, right?
Background checks are not a controversial issue. And it's not even a partisan. It's a bipartisan. There's bipartisan support. It's rational. You're not saying to people you can't own guns. You're not even saying you don't trust them. Right. You're saying, you know what? The one that used the gun to threaten his wife, maybe he shouldn't have one. Oh, yeah. And that guy who has a felony record, maybe he should. Oh, and the woman who's psychotic, you know, maybe she shouldn't have that gun. It's not very controversial, and it won't. Let's be honest, it won't go a long way to protecting Hydea Pendletons of this world.
Right.
So it's not even a massive reform.
It's an important reform.
Right, but
it's
I would argue
marginal.
It's important. It's still marginal in terms of the larger problem, but it is important.
Right.
It's critically important. And it's not representing even the interests of gun owners.
But Matt, I've been thinking, I mean, if part of what we've been trying to talk about today is balancing our individual rights over and against our sense of collective or common good, public safety is a common good, right? But we also do have a Second Amendment that has been at every point understood to mean that we have an individual right to gun ownership. How do we balance those?
Well, actually, it hasn't been understood that until 2008 when the Supreme Court affirmed it. That was a lot of people debated that. And that's one reason why their hackles get up when we talk about new kind of gun control legislation. You know, constitutionally, we have the ability to regulate guns. We have the ability to do background checks and these types of things. One thing that gets lost a lot in the conversation from the president on down is that it's very easy to tap into an emotion and then to posit that your opposition is obviously in favor of dead children.
Yeah,
and
right.
Is obviously,
right. And no one thinks
scared of the National Rifle Association, which is an organization that wouldn't have any power if there wasn't popular support for gun ownership in this country. There is. That's the problem, not necessarily this one lobbying organization. So all these things that we've been talked about, the assault weapons ban. It's been studied. It doesn't really have much of an effect one way or the other, and it wouldn't have had any effect on the underlying incident that precipitated this conversation, which is also true of background checks. It wouldn't have had any effect on this particular tragedy. That's worth thinking about, at least, or at least bringing into the conversation before you change a law.
Well, let me deal with the emotion piece for a minute, because in fact one of the Newtown moms gave the White House Weekly radio address this week. I thought maybe we could just listen to it for a moment.
I've heard people say that the tidal wave of anguish our country felt on 1214 has receded, but not for us. To us, it feels as if it happened just yesterday. And in the 4 months since we lost our loved ones, thousands of other Americans have died at the end of a gun.
So on the one hand, like I support Matt's point that we don't want to take people who are in opposition to us on a policy issue and say, clearly, you want children to die. On the other hand, the availability of guns in our country, one of the predictable outcomes is that children will die.
Yeah. Absolutely.
There are two things here. I think it's absolutely true to say, you know, there is no gun owner that I believe wants children to die. And I think people should be able to own guns if responsibly, right? And with some good limits because of the impact of guns, with some rational limits. We're counterbalancing interests to life and the protection of it, and interest to private gun ownership. The thing is that, then this is the governor of Colorado said, we, in passing similar legislation, did so in a libertarian state because we looked at the statistics, the data, and found that actually made a huge difference in the number of former felons, people who had threatened people with violent acts, preventing them from getting weapons that they were trying to get. So it's not that it has no impact or there's no benefit to it. At the same time, it doesn't solve all the problems. And so I think we have to hold both those things.
Right, but the incremental change is important in a we should appreciate that. And yeah, there has been a real difference in having these different voices and different faces. You know, here in New York City, across the country, there are 3,000 young black men that are killed every day, the same number of people that were killed in the World Trade Center, every year, 3,000. And that has been happening year after year after year. And now we have some movement because there are different communities that are speaking out, and that is very important. And we've got to take every single step that we can, but appreciate it, that it's not solving all the problems. But the other piece, I think, in looking at what the young man Dennis talked about, the other side of the economic argument, he said, you know, we need to show a dividend for peace. But one of the things that he said over and over again is that guns are everywhere. Everybody can get a gun. They are cheap, cheap, cheap. If we have more gun control in ways that depress the access because the price gets too high, we know we're going to have less young people and everybody else dead. Yep. We, you know, tax the heck out of cigarettes, less people smoke. Yep. So there is an economic imperative to making sure that people don't have access
to
guns.
Thank you so much. I don't want to miss it. He did start out by telling us, guns, that's easy.
That's easy.
And changing that answer can help to change those lives. Thank you to my panel, Matt, Maya, Sheena, and Lisa. Also, thanks to everyone at home who has emailed and tweeted and messaged and other ways of supporting this show during the week.